Welcome back to the Get Cyber Resilient Show. This week is our Behind the News episode. I'm Dan McDermott, your host for today, and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity expert, Garrett O'Hara. Today, we'll be looking behind the news of how police allege a Brisbane teenager built spyware used by domestic violence perpetrators across the world. Then, we'll investigate how Microsoft have accused an Austrian firm of misusing spyware technology. Then we'll look into how to secure the thousands of satellites now orbiting the Earth and their vulnerability to a cyber attack. And we'll end with a wrap of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. So Gar, welcome to episode 106. Let's begin by unpacking the story of police alleging that a teenager living in the suburbs of Brisbane created and sold a sophisticated hacking tool used by domestic violence perpetrators and child sex offenders to spy on tens of thousands of people right across the globe.
Yeah, so it's Dan, this is one that, hit the tech and cyber news a little while ago, but it did that thing of kind of leaping across into mainstream media. So, you know, it's been covered by all the sort of broadsheets because it is one of those stories that as you kind of dig into it, it's actually quite fascinating. I wonder, will there be a movie at some point? Because, just incredible stuff. Obviously, there was an arrest by the AFP of an individual. So, you know, they've kind of tracked back to who was the person that was involved. And, it was through information from the FBI and Palo Alto, actually. I had a really good write-up. I actually pinged that onto LinkedIn this morning because as I was reading through and prep for this, it was like, actually, this is a really, really good write-up by Palo. They were kind of investigating, as they do, various kind of malware around the world, and this rat showed up, so a remote access Trojan. Interestingly, the same RAT was used in the promotional material for the thing, which is called Imminent Monitor, but they had it as a remote administration tool. So still a rat, but you know, kind of trying to legitimize the use of it. And that's something that really, you know, kind of stuck out to me is that as you look at the promotional material and how this tool was positioned, the author, you know, the developer did what I think happens quite often, which is they try and distance themselves from the potential use cases, which can be really awful. And you might have mentioned this already, domestic violence and child abusers that are using these tools to do things like access webcams and do keystroke logging so you can log into accounts, etc. All that horrible stuff that you and I have talked about, you know, the stalkerware phenomena and potentially even leaning into a little bit of bossware in some of the use cases. When you look at the promotion for the tool called, you know, Imminent Monitor, it talks about things like fully administer Windows Server remotely, provide remote support to clients, friends, or colleagues, connect to your home computer while you're away, monitor employees' work machines, connect to your work computer while you're away.
Sounds all very legitimate,
doesn't it?
Great things.
Yeah, I was nearly going to throw the $25 at it. Well, obviously, it doesn't exist anymore. But just a really, really interesting positioning of a tool, on the sort of front screen of the website. But then when you look at the comments, clearly the tool has been designed to, you know, hide in the background, to do cryptors, to do things that really there's no real requirement here unless you're using it for nefarious purposes. And interestingly, the tool, I mean, obviously it was reasonably successful. The individual got, they're talking about $300,000 to $400,000 through selling the tool. And hilarious.
At $25 a pop.
Yeah, like
so
that's
pretty scary how many times that's been sold.
It really is, right? I mean, you're talking about tens of thousands of installs and all around the world, hundreds of countries, lots of different, you know, people using it for a variety of different things. And apparently a lot of the money was spent on takeaway and fast food. You just kind of wonder about the life that was lived here. This was a tool where folks started developing plugins, including one to hide the little light that comes on to show that your webcam is being used, mm-hmm. which obviously is a really good indicator that, if you, given we all work from home these days and, you know, the potential for somebody to be jumped out of the shower and walk behind a machine that might be on but the screen's off, at least you know the webcam is kind of active. But plugins being written to hide that little light. So, you know, potentially that's, I mean, you're starting to get into super creepy stuff there where, you know, people don't even know they're being videoed. And a little bit like the bossware stuff that we talked about a few months ago, you know, where you can monitor people You know, are they at their desk or are they not? Are they eating? Are they actively, you know, entering stuff on keyboards, etc.? So, you know, a little bit of an overlap with our friend's imminent monitor tool. Maybe there was a missed opportunity to go into the legitimate bossware space rather than the rat stuff. But yeah, like this was an investigation. Obviously, you know, lots of people involved. They executed 85 warrants internationally. 434 devices that were seized. 13 people were arrested. Huge global investigation. So, you know, pretty large, large scale kind of investigation to kind of get this thing done and dusted and taken down. Interestingly, there was two arrests. So and this is from the Palo kind of write up, but they were looking sort of to figure out who was behind all of this. And they started to do some investigation across things like Twitter and Twitch and a variety of different sort of places where this person had shown up, including the registration for businesses in Australia, and started to see female names with the same surname as the male first name. And you know, through sort of various investigations, they found the connection was basically, it was a mother and son. And it was actually through a Muay Thai fighting tournament, it looks like. And the screenshot on the write-up has that it's the first time in Australia that a mother and son fought on the same card. And I'm just blown away. You know, it's like that's the thing that kind of was able to link them together. But, you know, end result was that the mother was actually also part of, you know, the sort of dragnet and was caught up with that. And she's been charged with allegedly dealing in the proceeds of crime. So, you know, there was two people rather than just the main developer, which is, you know, mostly what has been covered in the media.
Yeah, we can put up, I think, that screenshot as part of the notes and write up from the episode as well, so people can actually see sort of, it is very strange, like how like that is then the connection that's sort of drawn the people together and understand, you know, the mother and son relationship there. I think one of the other interesting aspects, you know, and I guess the frightening aspect of it is a quote from Palo Alto saying that with such prevalence, we have to wonder why the author of this malware has been allowed to continue to profit from this for almost 7 years unchecked. That is disturbing, right? That this is something that is, you know, Imminent Monitor seems to be quite well known. It's available. It was something that's, you know, been around, but not around for a short period of time and allowed to sort of proliferate and then expand sort of globally, you know, over a 7-year period. That's disturbing. And you sort of wonder, like, how many others are there? And does it take, you know, this international police task force each time to be able to take these things down? Or does it need to be faster, swifter action to, you know, stop the, I guess, this, you know, perpetrating any further and then maybe worry about the police side? I do wonder a little bit about, you know, what needs to happen from an ethical standpoint as well to start to take back a bit of control.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's part of the whack-a-mole stuff that is cyber, right? It's that thing where, you know, this is one rat. There's tons of these things out there. It's not, you know, he's done something that exists in some form or another hundreds of times, different formats and different types. And you know, rats have been around for quite some time. And interesting to note, by the way, that he was a kid. He was 15 years old when he developed this tool. Mm. And, you know, you kind of think, well, and, you know, I hate saying this, but like kudos to the smarts to be able to actually develop something that sold so well. And what a shame that, you know, talent like that wasn't directed in a way that, you know, sort of was helpful and useful and, you know, brought over to the good side. I mean, obviously making $300 to $400 grand when you're 15, maybe not realistic if you do go through the white pathway rather than the black pathway or the dark pathway in life. Yeah. But, you know, really, to your point, Dan, like just a really long time frame for this to play out over. And, you know, it was taken down, I think it was 2019, right? If I do my math correctly, that I think works out. So, yeah, it was like, as you said, 7 years. But, yeah, just kind of just creepy. But probably a word to the wise and for people who are out there, you know, it is one of those things that, and I think this is actually a quote somewhere in the AFP write up on this, was we live in an age where somebody on the other side of the world could compromise a machine and be watching you, you know, go about your day looking at the keystrokes, like basically all the personal things that we do on devices these days. And they are personal, let's be honest. It's our banking. It's our or retail or shopping, you know, researching health issues if people have those, you know, like all of that stuff becomes then things that are exposed and available to literally some stranger based on the tools like this, you know, rats that are out there. Yeah, it's kind of a shocking world we live in.
Indeed, and like you say, if only his talent was used for good rather than evil, hey? So, and which sort of leads us into the next story of I guess similar note in one way of using spyware tool, and it's around that Microsoft have accused an Austrian firm of using a spying tool called Sub-Zero that apparently was intended for, and I say this in inverted commas, official use only by EU states, has now appeared up in the private sector. What can you tell us about this, Garth?
Yeah, isn't this it's a little bit like, you know, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter? And, you know, it's probably a little bit on the nose, but like there's a bit of that going on. Yeah, look, it's sort of an interesting one. It sort of hit a few of the, you know, the IT and cyber websites, and it's basically this firm who've produced a thing called Sub-Zero, and you know Microsoft found it and have sort of put out a statement saying that they believe it to, you know, obviously be not amazing and not something you probably want on your machine. So it's able to kind of access things like confidential information, things like passwords, login credentials, and it's targeted sort of an interesting set of organizations, things like banks, law firms, consultancies, and you know that idea that it's used for nation state is interesting. In that, like we know this stuff happens, right? And we know nation states are paying money for certainly 0-day exploits, things that will get them in and allow them to intercept communications or extract information, etc. Like that stuff is going on. It's been going on for a long time, and for big money too. That's the other part. I mean, if you got a good 0-day, cha-ching, like just, you know, crazy money for that stuff. But I just thought it was an interesting kind of comparison to our friend in Australia that's just been arrested. You know, similar-ish outcomes in terms of, you know, nefarious collecting of data and accessing things without them, you know, people necessarily knowing. And it seems like the only difference is who's doing it. That was the interesting part. And I was sort of reading through to try and do some background research in this stuff. And there was a phrase that jumped out at me, Dan, which I thought was, you know, business speak. And I'm guilty of it, right? You know, if you work in corporate, like it's almost unavoidable that you kind of use euphemisms. I think a friend of mine, when they were talking about letting people go, it was like they disconnected them from the organization. You know, we try and soften things and make them sound a little bit nicer than they actually are. But one of the kind of blurbs, the marketing blurbs for the organization involved, it has services including, and here's the phrase I love, an enhanced due diligence and risk analysis process, providing a deep understanding of individuals and entities. And I just thought that's amazing. Enhanced due diligence. I think that's what we should.
It's pretty good positioning for spyware, right?
It's amazing. Like it's just such an awesome phrase that I feel like I'm going to adopt and just see if people notice that you know, I'm actually talking about spyware. But enhanced due diligence on individuals. Maybe that's what the, I think the guy's name was Shockwave, or his, you know, his online handle, the guy who did the Imminent Monitor. Maybe he missed out on an opportunity there to use that in his marketing blurb.
Well, yeah, I mean, we talk about, like, you know, obviously the cyber skills involved to create these things, but it sounds like, you know, there's a marketing angle there as well. Maybe I need to go hire those people to help us with our marketing as well. So it's there's all of these things that, you know, are being used, not always for the right reasons. It is, though, like it feels like now that it has sort of crossed a line, and that Microsoft have sort of seen this appear in the private sector and are now sort of raising the flag, saying, hang on, whoa, like where is this going? So I'm also wondering, like, the firm's got that capability, but who's paying them to do this? Who is actually behind it at the end of the day that is actually, you know, basically paying them to infiltrate these private sector organizations? And how is that not an illegal activity that, you know, that does fall under the same sort of, you know, I guess police sort of jurisdiction as the first story?
All really good questions that I have no idea about. I suspect there's guys who, walk around in trench coats and trilby hats, and they sit on park benches swapping suitcases in front of duck ponds. And that's how, payments get made. I honestly don't know, but, that idea of what's, they're calling them cyber mercenaries, it's this sort of similar thing where, private organizations creating these access tools and information collection tools and using zero days, also called private sector offensive actors, which sounds a little less cool. I think I'd rather be a cyber mercenary if I was in that game. But yeah, absolutely spot on, Dan. But the reality is like behind the thin veil of society and safety, I mean, this stuff is going on day in, day out. And like to your point is that line between private sector and government sanctions, and that it's probably always been there, but it's a really interesting one. I don't know the answer.
No, and it's definitely something very sort of scary when you think about it, and you just wonder how prolific again is this. Like, again, we're seeing what is being caught, if you like, how much is going unnoticed. And I think that's also, feels a bit like the tip of the iceberg, right, of where we're at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. It has me worried. So like I'm, heading over to Black Hat next week, and I've been warned as you land in sort of Vegas, you got to turn off your Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, just switch everything off. And so I'm trying to find a Faraday cage clothing so I can just like put on some clothes in the morning and just feel safe inside my Faraday suit. I don't know if such things exist.
You have to buy a burner phone as well, then, it sounds like.
Yeah. So I've got a little, I was one of those people that bought when Nokia re-released the banana phone, straight out there and bought myself one of those. So I think I'm actually going to bring that over rather than my real phone.
Well, looking a little bit beyond where we are today, but looking at the final story for this week, is a look into how to secure the final frontier, space itself.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking off mic about this. This one, it tweaked my interest because I, for various reasons, was looking very deeply into Starlink as an option for internet, and which is fascinating and looks really good, actually. And, beyond the cyber conversation, be interesting to see how that plays out with the local NBN and things like SkyMuster. But spent a bunch of time researching what it was, how it worked, how good it was, and then saw this story show up on the Record, which is coming from Recorded Future. It's not a new concern. It's been reported by Forbes and a bunch of other places. But just an interesting thing to think about is, with the sort of emergence of the private sector and the amount of satellites that are getting thrown up into space, I think we're close to 8,000. Somebody can correct me. I think like there's literally thousands and thousands of private satellites up there, causing problems for astronomers and all of that stuff that we haven't had a conversation about as a society. But anyway, what it does do is open up kind of decent internet connectivity for regional communities. A lot of those kind of low orbit satellite communication systems. Actually, we saw that in Ukraine, right? There was that the shout out on Twitter from Ukraine to, I think it was probably directly to Elon Musk, hey, can you get us sorted with Starlink? And he sent over the kind of receiving stations, which I think is kind of cool. But what that leads to then is the conversation around how they're starting to become more critical. And I think that's the bit where, we all need to sit up and pay attention to what this means going forward. And that's kind of the thing here. There was a subcommittee on space and aeronautics. It was a hearing that happened, and a bunch of people kind of testified. People from a university in Buffalo and from the Center for Space Cyber Strategy and Cybersecurity at the University of Buffalo. That sounds like a place I would love to work. That just sounds so awesome. I bet they get really cool uniforms and stuff as well. But, all joking aside, this is a real conversation. This is something that we really need to probably pay more attention to. A lot of the commentary, having read through the sort of background reading for this, is that the communication channels are often fairly basic and unencrypted. And there's a history here where satellites have been sort of breached to the point where they could be controlled, but luckily weren't. And that one kind of had me sit up, or my eyes probably widened a little bit thinking about what that what that could be. It sounded a bit like one of those, you know, the James Bond movies back in the probably late 70s, 80s, where, you know, there was always some satellite that was going to get controlled and beam a, you know, laser beam down and kill us all. But, you know, that's the sort of picture I had in my mind. But much more mundane and sort of quotidien is the internet connectivity. So you got a bunch of regional folk who are, you know, get their internet connectivity popped, or in Australia, you know, we've got mines that are in the middle of nowhere and they're using tech like this to get communication back to, you know, head offices that are in main cities, et cetera. So, it's not just, private citizens and normal, you know, Australians, but actually this is potentially something that could impact large organizations that are significant contributors to Australian GDP. So, not a small consideration. And some of the things that, you know, probably seem kind of obvious is, you know, encrypting the communication channels for satellites, which, again, it doesn't seem like a crazy idea to me.
It seems amazing that it's not, right? I think that's the takeaway for there I have as well.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things that kind of jumped out to me was one of the sort of people testifying, or, you know, gave testimony, was exactly that, you know, the kind of securing of the channels for protecting the satellites. But one of the things that stood out was that the encryption modules be upgradable to quantum algorithms. And the reason it jumped out is that we're lining up an interview with a guy to talk about exactly this for hopefully next month, post-quantum computing, and what does that mean? And I think that's a really exciting conversation to have. So I'm like, here we are, you know, we're talking about space and quantum, and it all sounds very, very bleeding edge cyber.
Indeed. And from that, the visual I cannot get out of my head now is you working for the Center for Space Cyber Strategy and Cybersecurity, and in a space uniform, and having to walk into work in slow motion every day, and just, I can see it right now. And it's interesting that, like, and their quote is also like, you know, they're waiting for the satellites to be wiped out by a cyber attack. It's very, like, dramatic as well. Like, I'm sure, like, there'll be lots of other use cases before necessarily wiping them all out, but they're certainly putting it out there as what the ultimate risk might look like.
Spot on. That's interesting. You know, we sort of talked a little bit about breaking communication, and that's obviously not good, but with control of a satellite, you do have the ability to move things like solar panels and put them out of orbit and potentially crash them into other satellites. So actual physical impact to satellites in the world potentially. So yeah, interesting.
Indeed. Well, finally, let's wrap up with a quick review of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. Let's start with how an Italian school kid uploaded ransomware scripts to the PyPI repository just as a fun project.
Yeah, you gotta love this. Kids are getting in on the thing of these open repositories, right? I mean, we've talked about a log for shell, log4j, the issue with supply chain, or, you know, using libraries blindly, you know, assuming that they're okay, and you know, the potential risks, which are clearly highlighted here when you see a little kid uploading a Python script, and, you know, it was supposedly as an experiment. I love that. You know, that's, I mean, isn't that a get out of jail free card for any kid when they, you know, they break a window, or they get caught doing graffiti? I was just experimenting, you know, that's all I was doing. But, you know, it points to the very serious problem of using repositories and what that means, you know, copy paste of code, or referring even to external libraries sort of at runtime, so that, you know, as things get executed, they're actually pointing to an external library potentially, depending on the sort of coding methodology. And what you can see then is, potentially something that was okay today isn't okay tomorrow. But it's no more than that. I just thought it was interesting, just given the age of the person, and just a good pointer to like everybody be careful about what they're using from repositories.
That's right. Yes, like you say, and we've seen the fallout from Log4j, right? And so, you know, we don't want, you know, continuous sort of fallouts of a similar sort of scale and nature.
Yeah, DHA said, 10 years? I think we talked about that last news episode. So, yeah.
The next story is a data breach at the University of Western Australia.
Yeah, this is a short one. And the student information management system, which is used by a bunch of unis, it's called Callista. had been breached and not good. Personal information and things like grades of current students and potentially past students have been popped. It's been referred to the Western Australian police for investigation, but not good. And Callista popped out. I don't know if you remember the TV show Ally McBeal, but Callista Flockhart. I was like, there we go. I wonder, was it named after her? Probably not.
Interesting reminiscing there, Gar. Yeah. I'm not sure on that one, but it could be. You never know sometimes, right?
Yeah, the cyber link there is the dancing baby, because I'm pretty sure that came from Ally McBeal. And I don't know if it happened in Australia, but back in Ireland, the little dancing baby gif got sent around everybody on email. So we all had the little, the weird little baby dancing. I'm probably talking about something nobody in Australia even remembers, or it didn't make it over here. So forgive my parent insanity.
That's all right. We'll put that one down to maybe just the Irish community for that one. We'll see. The last story today is the latest findings from Google's Cloud Virus Total Research team. What have they found?
Yeah, just again, we all need to be careful. They sort of looked through how these malware things were getting kind of distributed, and how often it was happening through fairly sort of legitimate applications, or at least mimicking them. So using legitimate domains, then you can basically slip through things like domain or IP based firewalls. So just thought it was quite an interesting thing. And the reports, the thing that jumped out was said that 10% of the top 1,000 Alexa domains have distributed suspicious samples. And I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting.
Indeed. Well, on that note, thank you, Gar. Appreciate your insights as always. That brings this week's episode to a close. Who do you have for us as our special guest next week?
So next week we have Aaron Robinson. He's a security specialist, but also head of pre-sales over at Citrix. And we're having a zero trust conversation. And just a guy who kind of gets it. And, given what Citrix do, where they obviously spend a lot of time in those kind of hybrid working environments and things like desktop as a service, etc., they've got a perspective on zero trust that I thought was quite interesting. And Aaron actually has a really good analogy of zero trust and kind of uses the analogy of a bar or a pub, which probably appeals to me because I'm Irish. I'm going to embrace the cliche, Dan. Definitely a good conversation with Aaron next week.
Oh, terrific. Looking forward to that conversation and expanding my knowledge on zero trust as well, which would be great. So until then, if you'd like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump on to getcyberresilient.com and check out some of the latest articles, including Securing the Right Doors, How to Focus Your Awareness Training. Also, how long do you have to notice the life cycle of a data breach? And finally, there's an article deep diving into the open source risk, convenience versus risk, something we've discussed again today on those open repository and libraries. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay safe.